This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Actor Billy Porter made history at the Emmys Sunday as the first openly gay black man to take home an award for leading drama role.
Well, the category is love, y'all, love! I am so overwhelmed that I am so overjoyed to have lived long enough to see this day.
Another historic win went to 21-year-old Jarrell Jerome, who played Corey Wise in the Exonerated Five, the Ava DuVernay Netflix series When They See Us. He's the first Afro-Latino to win an Emmy for acting. So what do these awards say about Hollywood, as yet another ceremony gets dubbed So White? It's one of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context. Talk about the groundbreaking project from the New York Times that reexamines the legacy of African and American slavery. Controversial new Dave Chappelle Netflix special, and we will review new music from Missy Elliott and Rhapsody. Joining me for all that and more, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and a teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Natalie, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
Let's talk about the Emmys. That's what's up. A little bit more from Billy Porter and his acceptance speech.
James Baldwin said, "Took many years of vomiting up all the filth that I had been taught about myself and halfway believed before I could walk around this earth like I had the right to be here. I have the right, you have the right, we all have the right."
Billy Porter accepting the award for his role in the FX series Pose at the Emmys on Sunday, and with that win, as we said, became the first openly gay black man to win an Emmy for lead actor in a drama. And Natalie, what do you make of that? And reaction to the win and his speech?
Well, before I saw Pose, I mean, I didn't really know that much about Billy Porter. I follow him on Instagram, and so I've seen his outfits and his unapologetic, you know, way that he walks through the world that I really have a lot of respect for. He is very much so himself. He wears dresses if he wants to. He wears, you know, wings if he wants to. I mean, he wears whatever he feels best expresses who he is. And I think that that is like a message for the ages, you know, that you really latch on to being yourself authentically. And that James Baldwin quote is so appropriate, you know, not only for gay folk, but for black folk, for people of color in general, in a country that is constantly feeding you messages about who you're supposed to be or who we think you are. You do have to vomit that up before you can love yourself and embrace yourself and accept your own self so that you can share who you are and what you have to give with other people. So it was just a wonderful moment to see someone like Billy Porter win. But on top of that, he has been working so hard, you know, in the industry, in theater, in film and television for decades. So this was, you know, an appropriate and well-deserved win.
Yeah, and Mark, what about that? I mean, he is expressive, and anybody who's seen him recently in Pose and more recent roles would agree with Natalie on the way he's able to express himself. But what he just said, it took me a long time to get there.
It took him a long time. I mean, the generation of black gay actors that would have came before him would have never have imagined that moment, just like he would have never imagined it himself at the beginning of his career. What we're looking at now is extraordinary talent who is halfway to an EGOT. Mm-hmm. You know, someone will cast him in a major, you know, motion picture. Anytime he wants to, he can go into the studio and drop a Grammy quality album,
right,
you know, at this point in time. And so to have that platform on national television, right? And in many ways, you know, it was the tamest that we've seen Billy Porter in recent years. You know, I guess part of it having to do with the gravity of the moment. You know, he didn't have to have extra attention because the nomination was attention in and of itself.
Yeah, another another historic first on Sunday. Jarrell Jerome became the first Afro-Latino to take home an acting Emmy, one of the stars in Ava DuVernay's Netflix series When They See Us. Tell us more about Jarrell Jerome, Mark.
He's a young actor, and he first came on the scene in Moonlight. In some ways, he gave a really stirring performance in Moonlight, also in a movie that included so many great performances.
Yeah.
And so he plays the role of Corey Wise, who had, in line with the other exonerated five, had a extraordinary experience in prison. He was there longer than any of them. He went through a certain level of trauma. The fourth part of the series really was a standalone movie in and of itself about his experience. And so for that, for Corey Wise's experience to be able to be validated, and then for also for Jerome to win, an award for his performance. And again, he's only 21 years old. We can only imagine what kind of options he's going to have going forward.
Right. And I just have to lift up Ava DuVernay, because if it were not for her careful listening to the exonerated five, when they reached out to her to, appeal to her to tell their story in the first place. I've heard her in interviews and I've read about her process and the fact that she really listened to their stories, and she determined that Corey Wise's story deserved to have its own episode, right? That it did stand out. It did stand alone. It was different. And actually, I think Corey told her that, that I went through something different, and she paid attention to that. So I love the fact that someone like Ava, who has been so incredibly generous, I mean, just the way that she has used her platform to, bring different African-American female directors and filmmakers into the industry by giving them an opportunity through Queen Sugar. I mean, she does something similar with When They See Us. And I mean, she just looked like a proud mom, when Jarrell Jerome won. And I felt like she deserved that award as much as he did.
And we're seeing some change, certainly, when it comes to representation and TV and media in general. But Jarrell Jerome was asked after the Emmys in the afterward conversation, he was asked a question about people of color, that the award-winning roles, that the standout roles are still awarded to people who are portraying black pain. And here's what he had to say about that.
Unfortunately, I think our strongest stories are the stories of pain. Considering that's what we go through on a daily basis. So it is unfortunate that comedies or lighter pieces of work aren't as praised and aren't sent to the award season, especially when it comes to just everything going on. But I think the truth is that our pain needs to be told. So if it has to be for the next 20 years where we're just painfully telling our stories until we move on, then I guess it has to be.
That's Jarrell Jerome after winning an Emmy for his role. Natalie, what do you think?
I mean, I think he's right. Yeah. I think that, we're still in a moment where black folks don't really get to tell the full spectrum of who we are in through stories, especially through Hollywood. If you think about Moonlight, you think about When They See Us, you think about the films that have won awards of late. He's absolutely right. Those films have been centered around black pain. So I'm hoping that it's not going to take 30 years for us to get to the point where a lighthearted rom-com about black folks can actually be recognized for the acting and for the writing. I was thinking last night, Queen Sugar, which has amazing writing, which has amazing acting, which has amazing storytelling,
has never been nominated.
Right?
Empire was nominated,
yeah. I think. But Queen Sugar has never been nominated. Right. I mean, in any category. So that kind of speaks to what Jarrell is talking about.
And to Natalie's point, we'd like to see, what would it look like to see a black Fleabag, right? Mm-hmm. What would it look like to see a black Mrs. Maisel?
Mm-hmm.
Let alone even as we celebrate Billy Porter and Jarrell Jerome, the shutout that black women faced at the Emmys the other night. Ava again was shut out.
Yep.
Anjanou Ellis and also Niecy Nash, who were nominated for Best Actresses, in that role, didn't get anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's celebratory, but it still reminds you the limits of what's out there, right? The inability to tell the fullness of the stories, the inability really to represent the fullness of black talent, you know, on screen.
So is this kind of a lag time, though? Because we are seeing more of that kind of thing. We're going to talk about a black lady sketch comedy coming up a little bit later. So more of that is out there. But what we're saying is it's not winning awards.
It's not winning awards. And we always have to take into account when they see us, how that particular organization feels about Netflix. Right. That's also a part of it. So there's some Netflix backlash. It's also, I think included in why, someone like Ava DuVernay doesn't win Best Director.
And I also think that, to recognize something like Queen Sugar would also be to recognize Oprah Winfrey in a way that I'm not sure the industry is ready to recognize her, because she is moving and shaking in all kinds of ways. And she is a power broker for black talent and black stories that we don't really have. I mean, BET to a certain extent still does that, and maybe TV1, but Oprah, just the fact that she's had, Mara Akil and Salima Akil, what was the name of Love Is, mm-hmm. right? And Queen Sugar, and I mean, there's some stuff that I'm not really feeling on the OWN network, but she has some amazing work on there that I think deserves to be recognized, and I just don't think that the industry is ready to do it.
Let's talk about the series in the New York Times. In August, the Times released a groundbreaking project called 1619. Its release marked the 400th anniversary of the arrival of African slaves to Virginia. The project includes more than a dozen reported essays, photo essays, poems, and podcast series, as well as educational curricula. And I want to start with a clip from the journalist who spearheaded the project, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Here she is talking about why she felt this work was needed.
What we're taught is that slavery was marginal, that it didn't last that long, that it was largely just a product of the South. One of the common things you hear is, well, only 1% of Americans owned slaves, so it couldn't have been that big of a deal. We are certainly not taught that it was central to our foundation. We don't talk enough about what it meant that the first, 10 of our first 12 presidents were enslavers, that the entire Northeast also relied heavily upon the products that were being made by enslaved people, that the banking and shipping industries rose up to support slavery. So we absolutely don't think of slavery as foundational. We think of it as kind of a blip, a mistake that we made, but that doesn't have kind of larger ramifications for everyday American life. And the reaction to this project, I think, is evidence of that.
Nicole Hannah-Jones talking about the 1619 project of the New York Times. Mark, what do you think of this project?
I think it was amazing. The full range of voices that we heard, got to read. The absolute excitement about it, for many folks. But I was cautious, in how I felt about it. There's a way in which, the perfect way to think about this is that, how can we have such an incredible project right in the midst of Trump's America? But at the same time, asking the New York Times and so many of their peers if they had more diverse newsrooms and told more diverse stories over the last 40 or 50 years, we wouldn't have a Trump's America. I was also disheartened in the context of it, of the way that historical, traditional black media got erased in the context of this. Ebony is a shell of itself now, as one example. The New York Times has been very good with partnering with places like ProPublica and other sites. It would have been wonderful to see them partner with some form of black media, whether it's a BET or News One. I thought particularly about the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is a black-run outfit that basically pushes, black stories from independent black newspapers. I think that would have been a great opportunity to be able to share the wealth, if you will, around this story.
Yeah, we had Cash Michaels on here, who has been a reporter for a long time in African-American journals around the state. And he made that criticism. He was very happy to see it, very happy the Times is doing it. But the same thing, we've been talking about this for a long, long
time.
We've got a wealth of information, so knock on our door.
Yeah, I'm really excited about 1619. I appreciate very much Mark's reservations. He brings up a good point that, that I have been thinking about, but not so much in the terms that he just described. And that is, you know, even though the Times made this project available for free, right, to so that people who don't necessarily subscribe to the Times, don't buy the Times on Sundays or what have you, could have access to it. But I don't think that that rollout was necessarily completely thought through, because it still makes it still difficult to access, you know, unless you're a part of an institution like NC State or Duke, or unless you have the wherewithal to run around, you know, your city trying to find a Sunday paper that, you know,
right.
is still there that you can purchase for $7, you know, just so you can have the magazine. You know, I think that that could have been done better. And I'm trying to think of ways that I can, I mean, I'm really pushing it to just about every single class I'm teaching this semester, because I think it's important for students to be exposed to this information and this framing of our history, so they can rethink not only what they've been taught, but also get rid of some of this narrative around, you know, it was a blip. Slavery is not no longer with us. It wasn't that important. But one of the things that I think is really exciting about the 1619 Project that not a lot of people seem to be aware of, it, I just kind of found out because I was looking at podcasts, what is that there's a podcast
yep.
that goes along with the project. And the podcast is incredible to me, because even though there are just four episodes at this point, it does such an amazing job of really explaining in a way that probably doesn't come across as well in the written text, right. How foundational the institution of slavery was and is to just about every aspect of American life today, from capitalism to our music to healthcare. I mean, it's a really incredible breakdown. And that is something that I hope will be pushed in a way and promoted in a way that more people can have access to, because it's empowering. That's the word. It's
yeah.
empowering to find out information that you're not aware of. And you know, and for someone like me who teaches this material, there's still so much that I don't know. So I know that there are folks in our communities who are not aware of any of this information, but how I believe it would be so incredible yeah. for them to know and to be able to embrace and really absorb right. in a way that then lets them know, okay, I can like begin to turn a corner.
Yeah, you rethink this
yeah,
whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, well, and then you use the word foundational, and it's interesting because that conjures two different images, right? A foundation is something that's buried. But the thing that has the right really nervous and the backlash, the right-wing backlash that we're seeing, and we'll talk about Newt Gingrich in a minute, has to do with foundation as the thing that continues to support the edifice that you're living in.
Right.
It is continuing that what happened then continues to support what we have today.
That's right.
That foundation. So what do you make of the critique? People like Newt Gingrich tweeting that the series amounted to brainwashing and said, you know, why can't we get over this? And what is it about black people that want to just kind of keep pounding that? So we've moved forward.
It's almost disappointing coming from Newt Gingrich, because as bad of an actor that he's been politically over the last
right.
couple of years, the fact that we know that he's a trained historian, you know, so it almost comes off as, you know, you can disagree with it, but his critiques were disingenuous.
Right.
In this regard. And I think that's the reality of it. Again, in the absence of doing this kind of reporting over a long period of time, or at least highlighting folks that were doing this kind of reporting, it's easy for pundits to be dismissive of it as something that's more politically motivated than actually grappling with the legacy of what slavery has meant to this country.
Yeah. And I think that, it's easy to take pot shots at the New York Times because it's one of Trump's favorite targets in terms of fake news. So I'm sure there's a lot of discounting and dismissal of this project as, you know, non-substantial.
Yeah.
It's nothing. But the reality is, I mean, you know, slavery is as much with us now as it was, when it began. It looks different. It certainly has a different shape and form, but we have not gotten over it.
And the proceeds of slavery continue to support the privilege of those who didn't contribute to the wealth of this country through their free labor. Which has gone unanswered, unaddressed, and unremunerated.
Yeah, and I one of the things that I thought was really illuminating about at least the podcast, I mean, it may be in the written part, but is the idea that capitalism itself is its foundings, certainly I think it can be easy to understand it beginning in slavery through the free labor of black bodies, for hundreds of years. But the brutality of capitalism is a direct result of the brutality aimed at those bodies, right? That the ways that those bodies were mortgaged to purchase train lines and build buildings,
textile mills,
all of
textile industries,
right? And the disposability of these bodies, right? It's what we see today in the way that workers are disposable. There is no tolerance for unions. There's no protections for labor. You know, it's all a part and parcel of what came out of this peculiar institution. So it is disingenuous, for folk to dismiss this history that is documented as nothing. But it's par for the course because the status quo must be maintained, right?
Some of the same arguments really around the 1619 series actually swirl around the Atlantic article that was written by Jemele Hill. It's her inaugural article for The Atlantic, and it was titled, "It's Time for Black Athletes to Leave White Colleges." Mark, tell us more about that one.
It's an incredible argument. The argument's been made for a long time by various folks, but the fact that when you look at some of the best college-bound athletes in the United States, those who are African-American, they typically will always choose to go to a PWI, a predominantly white institution. Because of segregation, there was a historical period of time, 50 years ago, where these black athletes always ended up at HBCUs. It's really not until the late 1960s, early 1970s, that we start to see these shifts. And these shifts occur at the same time that collegiate sports really becomes the kind of billion-dollar industry that it is now. And so who loses out in that? For some of these athletes, we know that they're exploited. We know that they don't get very good educations. Some of them get a level of visibility that they are allowed to trade off on as professionals. But one of the folks who the group's entities that loses in this are HBCUs, who could benefit from the kind of wealth that is generated from television contracts and a range of things like that. And this is blasphemous, obviously, to some folks. But could you imagine if Zion Williamson and R.J. Barrett and Cam Reddish had decided to go to North Carolina Central, right?
Yeah.
Instead of going to Duke, and how that would kind of flip the tables, economically for HBCUs.
Okay, but here's the critique, and here's what we've been hearing over and over again, and let's listen to David Webb on Fox News make the argument and take the example that you just gave and use it as a warning for those athletes and what their future would be like had they made that choice.
My view and disagreement, vehemently disagree, because she wants black athletes to choose lesser of a potential future to satisfy her progressive segregation.
David Webb on Fox.
Okay. Yeah. So at the base of David Webb's argument is a clear anti-blackness. There's a clear belief in white supremacy. And this idea that HBCUs somehow produce a inferior product, right? And that is a part of the problem. It's something that black folks got to deal with. It's definitely something that white folks have to deal with. But it is a part of, I think, the legacy of integration, that somehow once we were able to make choices about where we were going to go and what neighborhoods we were going to live in and all these things, that our institutions no longer were good enough. And, Jemele Hill makes the argument in her article about how much how much HBCUs do produce in terms of Black doctors, Black lawyers, Black businessmen. There, I mean, the list goes on and on. So we really have to think about, like, what are we really right. saying when we start talking about, you know, that an athlete that decides to go to an HBCU is choosing a lesser yeah. future. Like, you know, that's really loaded, and we have to unpack that.
Well, and Jemele Hill did address that directly.
There are players in the NFL and the NBA who went to Black colleges right now, and they were found. And I think that's part of the mentality that some of these young athletes have. They think the schools make them. Teams want to get better, and they want to go where the talent is. And it's the same with television networks. They follow where the audience goes and where the talent is. And so from an exposure standpoint, I don't think there's any question that the exposure would certainly follow them.
And there it is, former ESPN host talking on NPR's All Things Considered about her recent Atlantic article. It's time for Black athletes to leave white colleges. And, of course, Mark, as you pointed out, I mean, think about the money that would go to those HBCUs. And if you look now, I mean, many of them are struggling. If we think back to Wilmington in 1898, when there was a chance to participate fully the capitalism was developing and have everybody participate where we would all be yes. right now. But when you get shot out of that, when you get blasted and murdered because you dared to participate and now you want to play when it's a multi-billion dollar game and you've been held back for
right.
half a century.
Right.
The equation, it seems to me, the math is a little different.
Right, because, you know, the easiest critique that you can make of HBCUs is that when you look at the infrastructures, when you look at just the physical plant of these institutions, particularly around sports, you know, they can't compete with Duke, right? They can't compete with NC State. They can't compete with that almost billion-dollar thing that they just built down at LSU. But this is the point. Had there been a steady flow of players, the talent coming to those schools, then those infrastructures wouldn't look the way they did, right? Let alone issues about infrastructure as it impacts the actual campuses outside of athletics.
Yeah, and, you know, to be fair, well, not to be fair, but to be honest across the board, like, I think athletes are going to be exploited in this yep. current environment, whether they go to HBCUs or PWIs. It doesn't really matter. Right. And that is something that has to be addressed.
Yeah, if you're getting a multi-million dollar contract, believe me, the person who's paying you is getting more than that. That's how
That's
we play
right.
our game. Hey, let's change now. Dave Chappelle, he released his latest provocative Netflix special, Sticks and Stones, in late August, causing quite a bit of controversy. Many critics saying this time he has taken it too far. Let's listen to a short clip.
I am what's known on the streets as a victim blamer. You know what I mean? Somebody come up to me like, Dave, Chris Brown just beat up Rihanna. I'll be like, well, what did she do?
Dave Chappelle, the new Netflix comedy special, Sticks and Stones, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, did you go too far? I mean, we're not playing. We're actually not playing the stuff that's the most offensive because, honestly, I don't want to put it on my hair.
This is the thing. It wasn't funny. Let's just start with that premise. I mean, with the exception of the Juicy Smollett thing at the end, it wasn't funny. And we have gotten, you know, the reason why we love Dave Chappelle is that we had become accustomed of seeing someone who would punch up at power, right? Would punch up for those folks who didn't have the ability to punch up. What we heard in Sticks and Stone was someone who consistently punched down. And there's only so much you can do that, particularly when it's not funny. And at this point in time, punching down is not funny at all to most audiences.
Yeah, I think Dave Chappelle is funny in his affect. Like his right. facial expressions, his body language, his voice, all of that is like hilarious. That's the danger of someone like Dave Chappelle, because he makes these devastating, really, jokes about that are misogynist, that are homophobic, transphobic. I mean, you know, you name it, he's got it. But folk laugh because all this other stuff is working, you know, in the background. And I'm less conflicted about Dave than I am really disappointed and also sort of wishing for the time, you know, a couple of years ago, a couple of decades ago, when his show was on the air, because that to me was as Mark was talking about, he was punching up.
Right. How much of this, too, and we've got just a little bit here in this segment, but how much of this is the other thing we looked at? He was punching up, but also crossing a lot of boundaries. And is Dave Chappelle at the point where this is the only boundary he's got left?
Well, I think part of it, we've got to understand about Dave. Dave is punching down, right? But he's punching down, or he thinks that he's punching up. Mm. Right, because what he's really, really supporting is the ideas of celebrities who have been wronged. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they're Michael Jackson or even R. Kelly or some of his comedic peers, you know, that's what he feels they need to protect. And someone made the critique, you know, he's now at this point that the only thing that resonates for him are the lives of his peers, right? Not everyday folks anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say that he's an elitist in a lot of ways. You know, the thing that motivates Dave is capitalism. And he even, you know, he said as much. So he's like in a different space than he was when he was doing his show, and it shows.
Let's turn now to a new comedy series from HBO called Black Lady Sketch Show. Natalie, tell us more about this.
So Black Lady Sketch Show is the brainchild of, please tell me her name, I always get it wrong.
Robin Thede.
Who is a Howard University grad, Bison Love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she has like this ensemble of black women who I think are funny as all get out. And then she has other people who are sort of guests that come on. And I think it's brilliant that this type of ensemble work is available on something like HBO. Mm. It's one of those things that I feel like is very much so under the radar. But the fact that it exists lets me know that, you know, I think there's a bit of hope that black women in particular are being allowed in very marginal spaces, because I don't know how much HBO promotes this, but it is being, they're being allowed to express themselves in ways that we don't typically get to see black women express themselves. And I think Robin Thede, especially since she did, she had a show for a brief moment on BET, you know, she was a good pick to like usher in this type of sketch show that I just think is really, really funny and very, very effective.
Well, let's get a sample of one of those sketches right here. This is a clip from one of them. It's actually a conversation with new recruits about their goals and expectations in a street gang. Let's listen.
The Reefs have an exciting year gang banging ahead of us, blippity blippity.
Sketch, sketch, sketch.
But first, let's mark these announcements. This year, we're excited to announce that you can now work from home 2 days a week as part of our new telebang policy.
Oh,
and we're increasing our paid parental leave from 4 months to 6 months.
Oh.
Lower my risk of postpartum like a mother. And just to be clear, we're not calling it maternity leave anymore because we don't want to be complicit in enforcing a cis-normative agenda.
Clip from Black Lady Sketch on HBO, Robin Thede, and Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal are with me on Back Channel. What do you think, Mark?
Again, to talk about what it means to have an all-black woman show. So Dime Davis directs it. You have Ashley Nicole Black, you know, one of the actresses, Gabrielle Dennis, Quinta Brunson. So you have these four black women who are predominantly here. And the thing that's amazing about it is that, and Robin Thede's talked about this in interviews, they don't feel pressured to make all of it right. Mm. You know, some of it misses, right? But they have the freedom to miss. And think about that in some sort of context. Like, because you can hear somebody say, well, why can't they be held up to other standards? Saturday Night Live has been missing for 45 years.
That's right.
Right. Not everything, you know, they
we have 25% doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we've allowed a kind of normative acceptance of mediocrity for white television shows. And so that for them to have the freedom to take all kinds of risk.
That's right.
Some of which will stick and some of which they don't. Talks about how important it is.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a great point that the show allows for these women to, like, you know, it feels experimental, actually.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it feels like they're trying out different things. They don't know how it's going to hit or not. And I found myself, you know, kind of like it's like a simmering humor, you know, but every once in a while I would laugh literally out loud because it was just so hilarious to me what they were saying, or, you know, I thought it was really clever, you know, a line, especially like in, what's it, Rome and Jalissa,
yeah.
which is a take on Romeo and Juliet. I mean, right. some yeah. of it is really brilliant,
yeah. Yeah.
you know, just the ideas that come, and I think, I mean, I love what Mark is saying about the opportunity,
yeah.
you know, to be mediocre.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, that is
just like the
like,
rest of America.
When you get to the yeah. point where you have that opportunity, then you actually kind of know you've arrived
yeah.
because now you're not being held to the standard that nobody else is being held
right.
to and
right.
that nobody can live up to.
Well, you know, you talked about it being experimental in a lot of ways, having some room to fail, a
yeah.
percentage is not going to work. Experimental, yes, but on the other hand, man, tried and true, and this is a form that has worked for white television for a long time, sketch
yeah.
comedy.
Yeah.
It has been the kingdom of white comedy, and yet it's almost like I've never seen this before, and one of
right.
the actors in Quinta Brunson actually talks about the kind of space that gives them.
It's revolutionary to have us dominate that space and have the humor be catered to us. There have been people who look and sound different, Black women, from each other for years, but that one box keeps like standing in our way. I mean, Wanda Sykes is totally different from Monique, and they couldn't be more different areas of the spectrum. And we have these women that are around, but that box has kind of been, you know, hanging over all of our heads. You either are in that box or you're not, and that's it. And so I think for us, defying to say that we will not be in that box, it's a little alarming to people, and they're experiencing a new sensation when watching.
Quinta Brunson talking about, with the Associated Press, about the new HBO series, A Black Lady Sketch Show, and I'm talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. Talk about that notion that she said, that it's actually kind of terrifying to some people to see, you know, black women move into the space.
Well, I was thinking when Quinta said that it shouldn't be. You
yeah.
know, we should be farther along in terms of general audiences being exposed to that type of the breadth of Black female comedy. The fact that there are in Black lady
sketch,
comedy
yeah.
sketch.
Comedy, yeah.
Four or five different women, right, who, you know, they're not the same. They all have a different yeah. form of humor. And to have all that packaged in, you know, one show, I think is, you know, it probably is terrifying for people who are used to just thinking about Black women as a monolith.
Yeah,
and especially Black female comedians.
And the sketches represent very different scenes that you're
Absolutely.
Going to see repeating. There can be the gang induction series, but there's also the society ladies sitting around kind of just gossiping.
The middle class, right?
Middle
right.
class.
Drinking and wine.
Yeah.
yeah.
But it's also created a platform for folks who never get thought about as being comedic. So when you see
yes.
that first episode with Angela Bassett, who we mm-hmm. have never thought about in that kind of role,
right.
there's a space for her now to be funny also.
Right, right.
Yeah. yeah, which again, if you think about the Saturday Night Live guest hosts,
right.
you know, the people who have been showing up there for a long time. Let's move on. Let's talk about music. Missy Elliott released her first collection of new music in more than a decade. The EP is called Iconology, and we should listen to a little piece of Throw It Back.
This is a Missy Elliott exclusive. Walk up in the thing, I be on my game. If it's competition, I put them to shame. Different kind of chick, we are not the same. I raised all these babies, call me Captain Jack Sane. Please don't steal my style, I might cuss you out. What you doing now? I did for a while. Missy, 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 go ahead, let it snap. I'ma snatch their wigs till I see their scabs. Booty, booty claps, flying across the map. Lambo on the block, looking like a snack. I show you how I do it, show you how it's done. Don't look for another Missy, cause there be no another one.
Watch me,
throw it back, watch me, throw it back, watch me, throw it back, watch me.
Throw It Back from the new Missy Elliott EP, Iconology, talking about it with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock-Brown. And fans have been waiting for about 14 years for this new album. Throw it back to what? Tell us who you know, Missy Elliott, and does she bring it forward in this?
Well, as the MTV Awards just acknowledge, she really is an icon of the music video era. One of the most prominent women rappers historically who made her mark in particular in music video, in terms of the kind of images of herself, but also just in terms of the presentation of her music. I'm sure there are folks, you know, as much as we love Missy Elliott, that after 14 years, we wanted more than four songs. You know, this is probably the EP, you know, that's going to come before a full album. But again, it's an opportunity. The fact that they call it iconology, right, for her to reclaim her position, right, and her visibility and her impact, I think it's an important statement at this point in time.
Yeah, and I mean, I love that every song on the EP, and even though there are only four, you know, is branded with this is a Missy Elliott exclusive, you know, which to me is her acknowledgement, but also her boast that, you know, this is what I do. This is who I am. I'm the one who created this. And, you know, I'm reminding you of the fact that, you know, no one, I came before all of these other people who are, you know, basically capitalizing on what I created. Yeah. And I love that about Missy. I mean, Missy to me is, you know, wildly creative. I mean, especially what Mark was talking about in terms of her mark on music videos. I mean, when she was at her height, nobody could touch her in terms of what these videos look like. But also, she's like the original, I would say, Lizzo in a lot of ways. Like, she's the one who, you know, could rap, could sing, you know, had these amazing beats, just eye candy for music videos. What was pushing this, you know, I don't care, you know, I don't care what you say about my body, how I look, how big my lips are, what, you know, I don't care about any of that. I'm badass. And Lizzo is the same. Mm. She's in that same sort of legacy, of continuum,
right,
you know, that Missy, I think, really was the beginning of.
And continuum, I think, is also an important part of this, that remember, this does, you know, come from somewhere and it's going somewhere. Here's Missy talking about her new album on the Angie Martinez Show on Power 105.
Well, it's harder now because I got to a point where I was not listening to, you know, and that's how me and Tim even had the sound that we had, because we didn't listen to radio, we didn't watch TV. So you don't see, you don't hear, you don't mimic. But now it's harder because
it's everywhere.
You know, you go even
your phone. It's on your phone. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you go to your phone, you might go look at a message, but something just draw you to the gram.
Yeah.
But you know it, you looking at everybody's pictures, your life just fading away. You just watching everybody else's pictures, liking stuff, and you know, so and you don't miss nothing because it's right there.
That's Missy Elliott talking about her new album. Talk about that, Mark. I mean, the fact that, you know, the impact of social media, and that's what she's talking about. You know, back then we didn't do much and I wasn't paying attention to what was on the radio, so we could create, and it's actually getting harder to be yourself these days.
It is, right? Because so many people have access to you, and the visual realm has now become ground zero for everyone to do the kind of work they do. So where she was a pathbreaker, you know, creating new spaces for this, you know, 15 years ago, now so many more folks are doing this and doing it with more resources, right? So it's a challenge for her to come back into the game in that regard.
Yeah. Well, somebody else who wants to pay tribute to what has gone before her and is making her mark on her very own is North Carolina's own Grammy-nominated rapper, Rapsody, released her third record last month, and it is a 16-track album, Eve. She calls it a love letter to all Black women. I want to listen to one of the songs now and note to our listeners, there is some language in this that some may find offensive.
I say what I gotta say, I am Nina Ari Berta, the one you love but ain't heard of. Got my middle finger up like Pac after attempted murder, failed to kill me, it's still me. Woke up singing Shirley Murdoch as we ladies edges down. Brown women, we so perfect, went from field nigga to steel nigga, being cropped out the picture. But we all know who got the juice, my sisters imitating us in all the Hollywood pictures. And still they'll never be us, nigga, nigga. From the backwoods when Nina Woods sing about the life we should lead. A new dawn, another deed. I tried to do some good. I felt more damn than Mississippi was. They denied Nina in Philadelphia. And still we persevere like all the 400 years of our own blood. Africa, old Panthers looking back like who gonna come up after us? Outside the movies, I make sure before it move you, it move me. Now bow down to a queen, please. Survival.
Rapsody. The song is Nina from her new 16-track album, Eve. Natalie Bullitt Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Tell us about that album and that song in particular, Mark.
So it opens up the album. It's a tribute to Nina Simone, a tribute to North Carolina in many ways also. Again, as you mentioned, she invented it as kind of a love song to Black women. Each song is named after, you know, a prominent, either real or fictional, you know, Black woman. And I think this is such a great starting point. I mean, she's now had this kind of tradition with her albums and her EPs that the opening track, you know, says does so much kind of political and aesthetic work for what's coming before. And I think Nina is a great example of that. I realized that Rhapsody's career was in a different space, making a late-night run to the Harris Teeter. And it was a dude who pulled up in a hoopty. I think he was either picking up his wife or his girlfriend or friend or what have you. You know, it's midnight. The windows are rolled down, and he's bumping Rhapsody's Eve. Mm-hmm. And the whole time that Eve has kind of been a thing here in North Carolina mm-hmm. and everywhere. I don't recall any other occasions of hearing people playing her music in their, on the stereo that way in their car. So there's something about this album that, you know, not only establishes her as a great rapper, as a great artist. I've heard so many people say this was the album where they finally got who she was.
You know, in some ways, she finally got. I mean, I was listening to an interview where she was talking about an interview she'd done previously, where the interviewer said, "You know, you're a singer. You're Nina Simone. You know, and he's naming all the great singers who had gone before." And she said, "No, I'm a rapper. I'm not." And then it dawned on her, "Wait a minute, maybe I am in that tradition." Mm. So to some extent, that was it. Seemed the epiphany or part of it that led to this album.
Well, I to Mark's point about how this album seems to be doing something different that perhaps Layla's Wisdom and the album before did not do, at least not in the same way. You know, I've been just so impressed with the scope of people on social media who've been talking about Eve and Rhapsody. I mean, from Jada Pinkett Smith, you know, shouting her out and just being like, oh my God, to you know, folk like Dr. Yaba Blay and filmmaker Byron Hurt, like everyone is praising this album. And, you know, I have to say personally, I'm still processing it. There's so much here. I feel like it is, you know, it is a deep album. And it's not the sort of thing you can put on in the background and hope to, like, really appreciate it. You have to listen to what Rhapsody is saying. But I also think that there is a quality to, like, even the samples just support the authenticity, I think, of who Rhapsody is. And part of what I love about her is that, you know, in a world where, as Missy said, it's hard to mimic. I mean, it's hard not to mimic. Yeah. Rhapsody is herself. She's unapologetically herself.
Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, Back Channel on the State of Things. Thank you for listening. A program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hullum-Moorman are our producers. Robin Copley, our technical director. Josie Taras, our intern. Thank you for listening to the State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.
Try.